Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and I want to keep this show pretty simple this time around. Largely, I've had a lot of time constraints over the past week, but what I want to play for you here tonight is a recent interview done by The Left Lens, which is, you know, an amazing YouTube channel. It's run by Danny Haifong, who's an amazing comrade, and Margaret Kimberly. And in this particular episode of the show, they interviewed an amazing African-American historian, progressive, left-wing, radical historian, Gerald Horn, Dr. Gerald Horn, who's an amazing authority on the history and study of settler colonialism in particular. Like, he did some amazing books, and about the emergence of racial apartheid in North America, in the colonies of North America. And he wrote such books as The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism and The Counter-Revolution of 1776. Right, books such as this, which I would recommend everybody checking out. But in this particular episode of The Left Lens, Dr. Gerald Horn talks about the origins of the conflict in Ukraine, right, and really puts it in really amazing context when it comes to just the development of capitalism in the 20th and 21st centuries, and the development of imperialism, and where that really has taken us right here and the kind of the danger that we are now facing. And he does an amazing job at that. He's an amazing, you know, just speaker and just all around amazing historian, and just definitely check out what he's got to say here. I won't say anything else. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
All right. Okay, well, let's get started. You did write this article, which I'll bring on the screen once you begin talking. I want to get your reaction to this ongoing Ukraine crisis. I mean, it is still happening. Russia is still conducting its military operation. And as you know, there has been a lot said and a lot of misinformation. So you wrote this article, From Crisis to Catastrophe, What is to Be Done in Eastern Europe. Could you talk about what you had to say in that article and just your general reactions to the crisis?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. This is a very perilous moment that we face. What's happening is that we may be on the verge of World War III. And if you listen to certain commentators from Eastern Europe, particularly from Ukraine, they say we're in the embryonic stage of World War III. I think that it's important to gain a bit of historical perspective with regard to this crisis. This is what I wrote in the article you just flashed on the screen. I think it's important to divide the relations between the North Atlantic bloc and Russia into three segments, pre-1917 to 1991, and post-1991. Now, as I say in that article, if you look at your map, you'll quickly acknowledge and recognize that Russia is the most, has the most territory on the European continent. It has the most resources, be it gold, petroleum, natural gas, titanium, which is necessary for the construction of airplanes. And it's the most populous nation on the continent as well, almost twice the size of number two nation, now known as the Federal Republic of Germany. And so that created a contradiction for many Western European nations, because as they began sailing south to plunder Africa and west to plunder the Americas, becoming alleged world powers, they did not necessarily dominate their own backyard, speaking of the European continent, and that led Napoleon about 200 years ago to try to resolve this contradiction by invading Russia and being soundly defeated. And then you had the so-called Crimea War a few decades later, with Britain and Paris principally ganging up on Russia. And then, in a turning point in world history, in 1904, you have London finance the Japanese attack on Russia, which Du Bois, Ho Chi Minh, Nehru of India, Sun Yat-sen of China all saw as a turning point in world history, insofar as it represented an Asian nation defeating, quote, European nation, speaking of Russia, which seemed to go against the predicates and suppositions of white supremacy. But it did lead directly to the Russian Revolution. It led also to the knockout blow delivered by Japan against the British Empire by seizing its cash cows of Hong Kong and Singapore in 1941-1942. And so, as I say in that article, in some ways, Russia is metaphorically akin to the whale in Moby Dick, Herman Melville's novel, insofar as Captain Ahab is the North Atlantic countries who are being driven to self-destruction, crazed self-destruction, in pursuit of this gigantic country, speaking of Russia. However, Russia was not standing still as these plots were unfolding, because it decided early on that it should attack its Western European antagonists at the root of their power, which was colonialism. And so even the New York Times, if you read the New York Times a few days ago, their correspondent in Johannesburg, who I hope I'm not getting him in trouble by not speaking ill of him, but he was reporting about the fact that in the, quote, global South, unquote, there's not as much enthusiasm about the sanctions regime, this boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Russia that has been inaugurated in recent weeks. And he pointed out that in another turning point in world history, the battle in what was then Abyssinia, now Ethiopia, in the 1890s, where the Africans repelled an Italian invasion, that there were volunteers on the ground from Russia. And of course, I had reported previously that Russia had armed the Abyssinians to the teeth to repel the Western European invaders. And we all know that there's a continuity, because during the Soviet period, 1917 to 1991, we know that the Soviet Union backed African liberation. That's the substance of my book, White Supremacy Confronted, which deals with the struggle to liberate Southern Africa from apartheid and colonialism. And indeed, current and recent research is revealing, and I hope our Black nationalist friends pay attention to this comment, that Marcus Garvey, the Jamaican who founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association about 100 odd years ago, was certainly pro-Lenin, pro-Soviet, even after it seemed as if he were getting in hot water with the U.S. authorities after they indicted him. And that's a subject for another discussion, why that particular facet of the Garvey program is not necessarily replicated by those who claim to be his ideological descendants. And this brings us to the 1991 to 2022 period, because what's striking, I think, if we're able to survive World War III, is that many scholars, at least the legitimate ones, may look back with wonder and puzzle over why there hasn't been more self-criticism. Perhaps the question answers itself. Amongst bourgeois commentators. I mean, for example, the United States spent trillions of dollars to dislodge the Communist Party from power in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And now there are non-communists, obviously, in power, the United Russia Party. And yet, now we're on the verge of World War III. You would think that somebody might say, well, wait a minute, maybe it was a mistake to spend trillions dislodging the communists. Perhaps we didn't think through the contradictions of European history that I've just pointed out with regard to this historic contestation between Russia pre-1917 and the Western European nations during that same era. But I guess it's asking too much to ask for a bit of self-criticism. But in any case, we know that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the spearhead of this bellicosity, came into existence in 1949, pardon me, on an explicitly anti-Soviet basis. You would have thought when the Soviet Union disappeared in 1991 that NATO would disappear. But instead, in their, quote, wisdom, unquote, the North Atlantic countries decided that they would incorporate Moscow's, the Soviet Union's former allies into NATO, including such statelets as Montenegro and North Macedonia. And under the concept of interoperability, what that means is they have to devote a significant part of their treasury to buying weapons from Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, the former home of Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. And then, of course, it creates this kindling that now has erupted with regard to this conflict. Now, I think that in the, quote, global South, unquote, one of the reasons why there hasn't been as much enthusiasm as opposed to in the North Atlantic bloc, because despite all of this blathering and bloviating about supposedly the world is united against Russia, actually, it is remarkable, and I wish they'd be more specific, it is remarkable that there is striking pan-European unity with regard to this crisis. Even Switzerland has overthrown its historic neutrality to join the boycotters, the divestors, and the sanctions imposers. And even Monaco has, in a sense, joined this particular venture as well. That's worthy of commentary, because many have come to think that the ultimate victor with regard to this crisis will, in the short term and long term, will be the People's Republic of China. And it's quite remarkable that on the eve of February 24, 2022, the inauguration of this special military operation in Ukraine by Russia, that we were marking the 50th anniversary of the Entente between China and the United States on an anti-Soviet basis, in a sense replicating 1904 with the London financing of the Japanese attack on Russia. And of course, that created this juggernaut in the People's Republic of China. And now part of the non-too hidden agenda is to use this crisis in Eastern Europe to turn the tables on China, because as the conversation, two-hour conversation, by the way, between Presidents Xi and Biden today, March 18, 2022, tend to suggest, that Washington thinks it has China in a corner. Either A, China will go along with these sanctions against Russia, which of course do not have the imprimatur of the Security Council, where both Russia and China have a veto, and therefore you're basically asking China to go along with these sanctions that do not have the authority of international law, which will then in turn weaken China's major partner to the detriment of China. Or B, if China doesn't go along with these sanctions, then Washington will try to encourage the European Union, which, by the way, has fallen flat on its face during this crisis, encourage the newly inaugurated leader of South Korea, President Yoon, a certified hawk, and other members of the so-called Quad, India, United States, Australia, Japan, to tighten the noose around China, and so that this competitor to North Atlantic imperial hegemony, not to mention white supremacy, could then be weakened and perhaps toppled along with toppling the regime in Moscow. Now, that's the fever dream, the wet dream, if you like, in the corridors of power in Washington. Whether or not it will come to fruition is another question.
You know, thank you so much for that that background, Dr. Horn. You know, these fever dreams, as you call them, to me are just insane. You made mention of 50 years ago, Nixon, the old Cold Warrior, the Red Baiter going to China, meeting with Chairman Mao and Zhou Enlai. And now we see an administration that seems to be terribly incompetent, to your point about the lack of self-criticism, who have brought China and Russia together. So the goal then was to keep China and Russia separated. That has been a foundation of U.S. foreign policy. Don't let them become friends. Except everything that the U.S. has done, including the 2014 coup in Ukraine, has brought China and Russia closer and closer together. And so we see headlines today that the U.S. is going to tell China, you can't side with Russia and you have to join us, which, of course, is suicide. That's okay. That's suicidal for China because they need their friendship with Russia. And if Russia loses here, then China knows that they are next. So there's so many other ways that we could talk about this inexplicable or seemingly inexplicable behavior on the part of the U.S. in this entire crisis. The fever dream of fantasy, I call it fantasy foreign policy, and we are all its victims living on a knife edge. We see people in Washington who should be fired. I guess Biden would have to fire himself. So at any rate, what do you think about all of the actions that the Biden administration has undertaken, which have led to this happening? And seemingly, I guess not seemingly, they want this to continue. The last thing they want is the best thing for the rest of the world, which would be negotiations. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, with regard to your earlier point, so-called geopolitical strategists in the United States of America, they have this idea and have held it for decades that whoever controls the World Island being the territory stretching from Lisbon on the west of Europe to Vladivostok on the east facing the Pacific, basically is in control of planet Earth. And right now, with the rise of the United Russia Party in Moscow and the Communist Party in China, the North Atlantic bloc, with the United States taking the baton from the British Empire post-1945, is far distant from controlling the world island. And so from their point of view, this present crisis in Ukraine presents a marvelous opportunity to reverse the tides of history by engaging in regime change in both Moscow and in Beijing, two nuclear powers. And this ties in to your other point, that is to say the politics of Washington, D.C., because the Democrats led by Joe Biden have been able to outflank many of the Republicans on the right with their belligerence and bellicosity and their warmongering. Mm-hmm. Republicans do not like to be outflanked on the right. They feel that that is their territory. In fact, they have an informal slogan of "no enemies on our right" that helps to shed light on their playing footsies with neo-Nazis in Charlottesville and elsewhere, not to mention in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. And so what's happening now is that many of them, not all of them to be sure, but many of them are scrambling to outflank Biden on the right. I would point particularly to Senator Rick Scott of Florida, mm-hmm. who is now in a traffic jam in his home state because a number of Floridians plan, as he does, to run for president, including Agent Orange, Donald J. Trump, Marco Rubio, little Marco Rubio, as Mr. Trump has called him, and of course, the windbag, Governor DeSantis. And so he has to distinguish himself somehow in his home state, not to mention nationally. So he's not only calling for the latest harebrained scheme coming out of Washington, which is a no-fly zone, which could involve United States and NATO shooting Russian planes out of the sky over Eastern Europe, which could trigger World War III. But he's also talking about transferring jets, fighter jets, to the battlefield, either through Poland or Romania or Moldova or Slovakia. By the way, I noticed that when you had this stage-managed meeting, supposedly in the Ukraine, although there's contestation about that, involving leaders of other Eastern European states such as Poland and Mr. Zelensky, that there was talk about transferring this S-300 missile defense system that Moscow has developed to Ukraine, but that would go against the end user certificate. It would be violative of the law, not that these NATO allies observe the law in any case, but I think that it is a non-trivial detail that should be mentioned. In any case, this has led to this bidding war in Washington with one party trying to outflank the other. It's utterly dangerous. It's opening the gates of hell. Hopefully, our peace movement will be strapping on their boots and taking to the streets because we have not seen the likes of this crisis, I dare say, in years. And there's one more point I should add, which is that right now, believe it or not, the fate of the planet may be hinging on the interpretations of lawyers, which is quite unfortunate, to put it mildly. What I mean is the State Department lawyers in Washington, D.C., their theory of the case is that Washington cannot be considered a co-combatant, a co-belligerent, even though it's transferring an arsenal to the battlefield, including Stinger missiles, which were so effective in Afghanistan, including Javelin anti-tank missiles, small arms, ammunition, machine guns. Now, presumably, they think that their counterpart, legal eagles in Moscow, agree with them. Because if they don't agree, and the Moscow legal eagles say, no, 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 you're a co-combatant, you're a co-belligerent, well, then that allows Moscow to attack that co-belligerent, which means these U.S. forces who are just over the border in Poland, for example, not to mention on the ground in Ukraine itself. And speaking of being on the ground in Ukraine itself, we're already constructing the next nightmare as the present nightmare is unfolding. I guess you could say that's a perverse form of optimism, that they must feel the world is not going to come to an end, so they're already constructing the next nightmare. What I mean is that they say that they're going to make another Afghanistan for Moscow out of Ukraine. You recall Afghanistan, I'm sure. In the 1980s, the United States made this de facto alliance with religious zealots, which not only helped to weaken the former Soviet Union, but then backfired with the, at least this is what we're told, with regard to the attacks on New York and Washington in September 2001. But it also created havoc in North Africa. Many of the religious zealots who were attracted from Algeria then came back to Algeria and raised holy hell. The same holds true for Yemen. One of the problems in Yemen, which is now being bashed by the Saudis, is that many of the Yemeni fighters who came to Afghanistan then came back and weakened the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, southern Yemen and Aden, which was one of the few, if not the only, socialist-directed regimes in the Arab world. And now, of course, the Yemen is on fire. So we already have these press reports of these legions of Euro-Americans and other Europeans who are flooding into Ukraine, presumably will gain skill and talent in fighting guerrilla wars, and then a la Afghanistan and Algeria or Afghanistan and Yemen will then flood back home to the United States, to Western Europe, where they will then unleash their grotesque skills and talents, quote unquote, on the rest of us. Already, there is a foundation for that because we already know about the pre-existing strength of the right wing in the United States of America, in Western Europe, where it's taken even more toxic form in the sense of the Alternative for Germany party in Berlin, in terms of Eric Zemmour, the right winger who is contesting for the presidency of France and has attracted significant support according to recent polls. So, as I said, they're constructing the next nightmare, even though the current nightmare has yet to be terminated. So obviously, it behooves all of us to work overtime to dislodge these miscreants from power. They've forfeited any credibility that they may have had. And certainly, it's in our self-interest to make sure that they're no longer around to construct the next nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, those are really good points. And this whole notion of a no-fly zone over Ukraine has been quite striking for me. And the fact that the president of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky, who was elected on the premise that he would de-escalate and demilitarize the country as it was embattled in a civil war, still is. That's a huge part of this current crisis, is the fact that Ukraine has been bombarding and shelling eastern Ukraine, Donbass, for 7-8 years now, to the detriment of 10+ thousand lives. But nonetheless, this whole idea of a no-fly zone, as you said, it really does risk World War III. It's both the risk of shooting down Russian forces in the air, but also Russia is a military power. It has anti-aircraft missile weapons, which can also fire back. And that would mean also, if Article 5 of NATO's so-called constitution is triggered, that would mean that Russian territory itself would be ripe for a strike of many kinds. And so I think that just shows how dangerous the situation is right now. And as you said, you know, where is the peace movement in all of this? And I would like to, if you could comment on that question, right? Where is the peace movement? And maybe if you could give a bit of history about, you know, how has Russia been looked upon by the peace movement? I know that you've written extensively on Du Bois and Robeson. Could you talk about, you mentioned in the article, right, there was this period where in order to gain concessions in the Jim Crow, you know, against Jim Crow, there was an abandonment of this peace orientation, this internationalist orientation that was held by the likes of Robeson. Could you talk about that and what lessons we could learn today for the current peace movement?
Well, point number one, I made a critique of some of our representatives in Washington, D.C., singling out Senator Rick Scott and President Biden. I could have extended my remit easily, I'm afraid to say, to some members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And of course, our co-host Margaret Kimberly has been waxing upon that quite a bit of late. Even Barbara Lee, who stood tall in 2001 with regard to the crisis in Afghanistan, has decided to throw in her lot, I'm afraid to say, along with other members of the Congressional Black Caucus, with the warmongers. Now, on the one hand, as your prefatory comments suggested, we can see this as flowing inevitably from what I call the Compromise of 1954, whereby in return for anti-Jim Crow concessions, the tallest trees in our forests, who tended to be of the left, were isolated, persecuted. W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, at the age of 83 in 1951, is handcuffed and tried criminally for being the agent of an alleged foreign power, unnamed foreign power, I should say. That foreign power, not mentioned in the indictment, is the People's is the Soviet Union, because Du Bois was advocating banning the bomb, banning nuclear weapons. And so that had to be a communist plot. And therein, you begin to see the crisis that emerges in the peace movement, because as was said during the bad old days of slavery, you only need to beat one slave to keep the entire plantation in line. And so when you put a man of the eminence of W.E.B. Du Bois, who is a leader of the Peace Information Center, on trial, this sends a signal to the rest of the peace movement that if you veer too far out of line, you too can be indicted. And unlike Du Bois, you won't be able to get international press and have the lawyers from the left, from the National Lawyers Guild, come to your defense. You can look forward, I'm afraid to say, to a lengthy jail term. And the same holds true for other people on the left, including Paul Robeson, who incurred the wrath of the U.S. authorities in 1950-1951 when he filed a petition at the United Nations charging the U.S. with genocide against Black people. His income plummeted from the six figures to the four figures. His passport was taken. He was finding it difficult to have concerts. His records were being taken out of stores because, of course, as you know, he was a world-class actor, singer, intellectual, linguist, etc. And this, of course, only began to end when you had his friends in India, led by Prime Minister Nehru, began to clamor against that sort of thing. And then let me mention one more point in this regard to link this directly to the Congressional Black Caucus, because not so long ago, a leading light in the Congressional Black Caucus was Congressman George Crockett of Detroit, Michigan. Congressman Crockett came into prominence most directly in 1949 when he was the lawyer for the Communist Party in the what was then called the trial of the century, the trial of the Communist Party leadership. He was a lawyer for Ben Davis, who had followed Adam Clayton Powell into the New York City Council on the Communist Party ticket, 1943 and 1945, then put on trial in 1949 and jailed by 1950-1951. Crockett, his defense of Ben Davis was so vigorous that he was jailed after the trial. He served months in federal prison on contempt of court. And of course, the court merited contempt. And so we see that this was the background of many members of the Congressional Black Caucus previously. I think, Margaret Kimberly, you mentioned that Mr. Crockett's fellow Detroiter, John Conyers,
yes,
before he passed away and left Congress, was railing against the Azov Battalion, yep, of Ukraine, which, of course, we know as a neo-fascist, neo-Nazi formation. Congressman Ronald V. Dellums, to connect these threads, was the predecessor of Barbara Lee in the Congress of the United States representing Oakland, Berkeley. Congressman Dellums, the late Congressman Dellums, was known for his close camaraderie with the Black Panther Party, his close friendship with Bobby Seale, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, also from the San Francisco Bay Area. And we all know what happened to the Black Panther Party, how they were subjected to murderous attack, as represented most recently in the Hollywood film Judas and the Black Messiah. And so I guess you could say, if you wanted to factor in every element of the equation, that the Congressional Black Caucus of today did not have the benefit of these searing experiences of a George Crockett or Ronald V. Dellums. So perhaps we should not necessarily be shocked or surprised that they are wanting in 2022, although if you want to subject that point of view to criticism, saying I'm being much too charitable, I won't object. They will have to defend themselves.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's an interesting history, what's happened with Black politics, the way, and just to be frank, they've been bought off. There was a time when they were left alone. And then, as the as neoliberalism strengthened, and then they said, well, we can't leave these people over here unbought. And they decided who was and wasn't going to be elected, who would be defeated. And the end result is a Black caucus that is pretty much like the rest of Congress. But anyway, but I had another question for you. You know, we all see the war propaganda that we're being subjected to. I have no recollection of anything like this in my life, where every members of Congress are, you know, have blue and yellow flags and saying glory to Ukraine while also claiming it's not really a fascist statement, even though it was. So we have a population that has been deliberately dumbed down, dependent upon corporate media, which works hand in hand with the state. So we have, a public who I don't think realize the danger that we're in. We see members of the media goading the Biden administration to war. Aren't you going to stand up to Putin? Aren't you going to call his bluff? It's horrible. So we have a public, the anti-war movement is small, but the vast majority of people have been so indoctrinated. What are your observations about that, this overwhelming indoctrination that has become accepted by the vast majority of people?
Well, it's a complex question. As you know, one of the subjects I've written on of late has been the origins of settler colonialism in North America, stretching back to the 16th century. And if you look at that embryo in the 16th century, one of the points that leaps out to you and that is stressed in my book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, is that amongst the European migrants who were crossing the Atlantic to settle, quote unquote, what they called North Carolina in the 1580s, that it's a multi-class formation and that historically, settler colonialism in North America has operated on the principle of class collaboration between and amongst those of European descent, reconstructed as, quote, white. Eventually, of course, this helps to leave their major competitor, speaking of Catholic Spain, flat-footed, because an axis of differentiation for Catholic Spain, of course, was religion. You could be a conquistador, an African, if you profess Catholicism. But with the transition from religion to, quote, race, unquote, or pan-Europeanism, if you like, Britain was able to co-opt Catholics. If you look at the history of Maryland, for example, it's basically started by Catholics in the midst of supposed religious conflict. Baltimore, for example, the same. And so we shouldn't be overly surprised that even in 2022, hundreds of years after the formation of settler colonialism, that class collaboration is still a fundamental tenet with regard to the alleged and purported stability of the United States of America. We all know, even contemporary analysts recognize, that since the Democratic Party in the 1960s seemed to be moving towards the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that they have not won a majority of the Euro-American electorate since then. 1991, David Duke, a Nazi and Klansman, runs for governor of Louisiana, 1991, in the lifetime of many of your audience, and receives 55% of the Euro-American vote. And so these are difficult realities to either absorb or accept. And so I find that most people try to sweep it under the rug, which I sort of understand, except that now it's sort of catching up with us. And speaking of catching up with us, I do think we need to, it's not premature, it's not too soon to begin to do an analysis of the victors and losers with regard to this conflict. I think that Ukraine certainly is a short-term loser and a long-term loser with regard to this conflict. The United States will probably be a short-term beneficiary and a long-term loser. What I mean by that is that in the short term, it seems as if they've been able to co-opt the European Union, the giant with the feet of clay, with President Macron's line about strategic autonomy of the European Union going into the wastebasket, apparently. If this were an investment show on CNBC, I would be advising to buy the stock of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, perhaps Boeing, for example, because it's interesting in terms of collective wisdom. I noticed that the Germans rearming, which is one of the most frightening aspects of this whole escapade, they're deciding not to buy French jets, but U.S. fighter jets, which left me somewhat baffled. I don't know if that was a head fake, a multi-million dollar head fake on their part, or I should draw some other inference from it, but it's really remarkable. But I think the European Union will be a short-term loser and a long-term loser unless they reverse course. They're going to have to deal with an energized ultra-right wing, per my comments about creating an Afghanistan in their backyard. They're going to have to deal with millions of refugees. And although we know that these Ukrainian, quote, blonde and blue-eyed refugees do not receive as much flack as those from North Africa and Western Europe, inevitably, it seems to me, it's going to be a strain on the budget of Brussels and the various capitals. And then, in the pièce de résistance, they're being asked to join the new Cold War against China, their major market. They're being asked to find a new energy source other than Russia. And so now I saw these articles about they're thinking about building a pipeline from Nigeria up to the Mediterranean. And I was thinking, don't they read the newspapers? I mean, what do they think Boko Haram is going to say about that? And all these religious zealots they helped to fund in Burkina Faso and Mali and elsewhere. So the European Union is in a real jam. And if there were any wisdom in the leadership, they'd be leading a fast break away from Washington. China seems to be a short-term victor and a long-term victor. But, of course, that's dependent upon circumstances that are yet to unfold concerning this anti-China alliance, whether or not the United States, as they used to say in the old cowboy movies, might seek to get the drop on the Chi-Coms by launching a preemptive strike against them because they won't go along with sanctions. And they're funding Russia's, quote, adventurism, unquote, in Eastern Europe. But that seems to be the preliminary tally. But as I said, these events are unfolding at a fast and rapid rate. And please allow me an opportunity to revise and amend my prognostication as the situation might demand.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is moving very fast. And I think you're right that we don't have a crystal ball, but we can definitely see the current trajectory where things are going. And it's very interesting you brought up how Ukraine refugees coming out of Ukraine are being portrayed in the mainstream Western media, especially as being blonde hair and blue eyed and as being worthy, unlike the millions upon millions of refugees from places like Libya, Yemen, and Syria, and et cetera, which the European Union had a heavy hand in helping create, along with its imperial master in a lot of ways, the United States, and how they are being portrayed as unworthy and as being sort of deserving of their absolutely destitute and a really horrific fate. But one interesting thing about this, I think you bring up a really good point about how these refugees are still going to create havoc for the economies and also the social life of these extremely racist countries. I mean, these countries have a huge race problem. The whole entire Western world right now is coming apart at the seams, in large part because these tensions continue to be stoked, continue to create irreconcilable divisions in society. And all the while, you have the United States and the West claiming that Ukrainians are white, but they're not fast-tracking EU membership, and they're not fast-tracking NATO membership. They're keeping Ukraine as essentially how it's been treated since 2014 and even before that, as a convenient launch pad, a sort of a vassal state, a weak country that can be super exploited by the US and NATO for its larger aims, this new Cold War. I wonder what you think about this new Cold War generally. You made really good points about China and Russia and how they are very close to Europe. And so Europe is really in this bind because a lot of European countries have signed on to the Belt and Road. A lot of European countries rely on Russia as a huge market for energy. I mean, where is this new Cold War going to go if at the base, economically, Europe is sort of, I don't know, it's caught between a rock and a hard place. How can this new Cold War continue on in the U.S.'s liking, at least, when some of its most valuable allies in Europe cannot help but be dependent on these growing powers of the East?
Well, I think obviously we need new thinking in Brussels, which may not be forthcoming, because obviously they're being played by Washington. Washington starts a brush fire in their backyard and then goes hides behind that formidable border known as the Atlantic Ocean, and then gives counsel and advice. And as I said, why the European Union, a market of 450 million, larger than the U.S. capitalist market of 330 million, bends the knee to the United States of America is somewhat baffling. Now, I know that the titular political leader of the EU, speaking of France, needs U.S. aerial and satellite assets to maintain its neo-empire in West Africa. That's the import of the ongoing crises in Burkina Faso and Mali, amongst other places. But still, it is still staggering to contemplate how and why it is that this crisis has unfolded. I should also say that with regard to Ukraine itself, the major player and how it's being manipulated, it reminds me of how Britain soared to prominence in the 16th century. Because as I say in that very same book that I mentioned a moment or so ago, Britain became very adroit and adept at getting other powers to fight its battles for it. For example, in the 16th century, when it was first getting started, you saw that London was willing to fight Spain to the last Dutchman. And of course, if you had been around in, say, maybe 1610, you would have thought that the Dutch were on a glide path to being what the British Empire turned out to be. But of course, they absorbed too many blows of fighting ultimately on behalf of London and were ultimately weakened. And so now you see that Washington is willing to fight the Russians to the last Ukrainian. And the Ukrainians, or at least the leadership in power today, seem to be willing to go along with it. But you also mentioned this question of the refugees and the racialized discourse that's encompassed them, which I'm afraid to say has also ensnared Al Jazeera. I mean, I had Al Jazeera as part of my steady media diet until they decided to go along with this utterly racist reporting. It really doesn't make sense even from a marketing point of view, because if I want to listen to that sort of reporting, I don't need to go to Al Jazeera. I can MSNBC, CNN. So even from a profiteering point of view, it really doesn't make that much sense. And certainly, I think that that sort of reporting is a factor in one of the underlying issues of this entire conflict, which is the reaction of the Global South, how four dozen plus nations at the General Assembly vote castigating Russia either voted to abstain or did not show up. And this included most of the nations of Southern Africa, including South Africa, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and included Algeria and Senegal as well. And I think that for many in the Global South, they've had it up to their keister with this hypocrisy of the North Atlantic bloc. That is to say, all of this blather about the first conflict on the European continent since 1945, sweeping under the rug what happened in Yugoslavia, where, by the way, you may recall the United States punched China in the nose by destroying its embassy in Belgrade, a direct signal to a rising China. Not to mention exceeding its mandate, United Nations mandate in Libya, by moving to topple Gaddafi and engage in regime change, which utterly outraged the African Union, which was engaged in mediation efforts that were coming to fruition before the Obama-Biden team, backed up by Samantha Power, Susan Rice, and Hillary Rodham Clinton, decided to exceed the mandate. And then, of course, that debacle in Afghanistan, which was a NATO venture, although I had thought, according to Mr. Stoltenberg, their leader, that this is an alliance that's focused on Europe and that is a, quote, defensive alliance. He seems to have that comment on speed dial. Obviously, he's forgotten about Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Libya, et cetera. And so the Global South, they've had it. And this is maybe part of the ironic good news, because back to World War II, many on the left, which for reasons that you could see it's legitimate, found themselves on the same side as Washington and Moscow fighting Germany and Japan, they thought that the leopard would change its spots, this would mean going forward that the lion would lay down with the lamb and imperialism had transformed itself. Many on the left, I've written about it, actually believe that. I don't think many people on the left today are saying, because this boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has taken flight with regard to Russia, that we can now expect it to take flight with regard to Israel. I don't hear too many people saying that. So that's part of the good news. Whatever naivete that may have been lingering on the U.S. left, I would hope and imagine has dissipated, if not disappeared. Which brings me to my next point, which is that Pepe Escobar, who writes for Asia Times, had a piece the other day about, in the midst of this crisis, the EEU, the Eurasian Economic Union, under the putative leadership of Moscow, has now co-opted China. And there's this new bloc that's developing that, if we can resolve the tensions between Delhi and Beijing, could include India, which, of course, is now buying energy from Russia on a basis of sending rupees, the Indian currency, to Moscow, and then the trade going the other way will be in rubles. You see that the Saudis are talking about trading oil with China using the Chinese currency. we see that Washington sent a mission to Venezuela in light of turning its back on Russian energy. Of course, that's outraged Senator Rubio, Senator Menendez, and we'll have to wait and see what happens with regard to that venture. But in any case, all of these points reflect that a new international situation is giving birth. And like with any birth, there are going to be birth pangs, I'm afraid to say. And that's an optimistic way, perhaps an overly benign way, I'll grant you that, of looking at this current situation, that we're in the midst of one of those rare events, a transition in the global correlation of forces that hopefully will be a benefit to humankind, unlike the correlation of forces it's hopefully replacing.
You know, I do want to be optimistic, and all the things that you just mentioned, those are all very positive signs for the whole world, that the world is becoming more multipolar. That's a good thing. That's what we need. But I have this lingering fear about my own country and how it will respond. We've talked about their incompetence, their inability to be self-critical, and I fear what their reactions will be. They veer from bellicosity to panic. So in the case of Venezuela, they said Maduro wasn't even the president, and then they run down there hoping to get his oil. So these are not the smartest people, just to be blunt about it. And I just feel they are constrained by their history, by their fantasies, and how they will respond while the rest of the world behaves in a rational way, and everything you've just described is a rational outcome, that we live in an irrational country. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, also keep in mind as well, and this is something I think we should trumpet on Black Agenda Report and other organs to which we have access, we need to ensnare our antagonists in their own contradictions. Mm-hmm. What I mean is, despite this boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Russia, which has taken off like a rocket in recent days, already you see the point that it does not encompass the third largest bank in Russia, which is Gazprom, which is tied to the natural gas behemoth, which sends natural gas to Germany and the other sites in Europe. And of course, I'm speaking to you from Texas, and the sound you might hear in the background is corks and champagne bottles popping as those in the Petro Metro are dancing in the streets at the prospect of capturing markets from Gazprom that they had not held heretofore. But interestingly enough, so Gazprom has this bank, the third largest bank in Russia, which finances all these transactions. It's not being boycotted. So don't be surprised that within months, Gazprom is the number one bank in Moscow. Likewise, you've had Exxon and BP make quite a to-do about exiting Russia along with its comrades and the Fortune 500. But that does not apparently encompass Total of France, the energy giant of France. So since these folks in the United States seem to be so hysterical about Russia, you know, they're boycotting Tchaikovsky, who died two centuries ago. They're boycotting Dostoevsky. We were told that we should have a wall between art and politics and sports and politics, but concert singers and orchestra conductors are being made, not just to denounce the war, but to denounce Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they'll lose their jobs. So we should ask them, what do you think about Gazprom Bank? I mean, I'm not saying you should extend, but people need to be faced with the contradictions. I mean, they should be made forced to answer. When are you going to get in Macron's grill about Total, for example? So I think that there are a number of opportunities opening up for us in the radical movement, the progressive movement, the peace movement. As one door closes, another opens. You know, the old saying about the Chinese character of peril comprised of both danger and opportunity. I think that obviously there's a danger we've spent time talking about in terms of World War III, but there's an opportunity.
Yep.
It seems to me to play on these contradictions, to attack our foes, to get them to own up. Because, you know, at these Ivy League universities, they have entire curricula on grand strategy, which are designed, quite frankly, to maintain U.S. hegemony forevermore. And now we're talking about U.S. hegemony being potentially jeopardized. So what happened to grand strategy? I mean, shouldn't these professors be criticized, or should they engage in self-criticism? Should the curriculum be revamped? I mean, should they start to invite Margaret Kimberly and Danny Heifong to lecture?
Yes. And Dr. Horn, yes.
Well, so, I mean, these are the kinds of questions that we should be raising. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, the ensnaring the Western imperial powers and their own contradictions sounds like a really good idea. And I think it gets to this idea that I was thinking about as you were talking, was how, you know, globalization over the past 30 years since the fall of the Soviet Union, there's a huge catastrophe portion to it, of course, especially what happened to Russia. But we know how the United States used it as an opportunity to expand its hegemony, the endless wars, the backbreaking austerity. But at the same time, what also happened over this period was there has been a real interconnectivity that has happened across the world, and that countries like Russia and China, especially China in the economic realm, but even Russia, as we're seeing now, are deeply integrated in the overall global economy, making this new Cold War really suicidal for the United States and Europe in so many ways, for the US and NATO in so many ways, yet they continue on in this very confused manner in so many ways. We see how there's all of this bluster to try to isolate, starve, and hopefully regime change Russia, but at the same time, they are very keen on their hesitation about the no-fly zone request from Volodymyr Zelensky. So there is this really contradictory policy that's being undertaken in this new Cold War that does open up an opportunity to expose the political side of all of this. What are the politics involved, and how do we intervene so that it isn't just the chorus of imperialism singing the song of the day and singing the song of the moment, but that we can actually begin to write history? Because at the end of your article for Black Agenda Report, you say very, very specifically that there are so many lessons to draw from this moment, but a better understanding of history and the international correlation of forces is a huge one, along with the collectives and the movements that we need to take advantage of these moments. I don't know if you want to close on that, and also just tell people where to find you as we end here.
Well, as is evident, I'm not underground yet, and let's keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully that won't have to happen. But I would say that certainly the point that I would raise until there's not a breath in my body is that our movement needs, obviously, to be more internationalized and globalized. That's how we are able to level the playing field with regard to the strength of the right wing in this country, for example, because that is their Achilles heel. And the opposite of an Achilles heel is what we enjoy when we venture across borders and across oceans. I mean, when we talk about slavery, for example, we know that it not only was able to be defeated because of internal struggle, but also there was external struggle. The Haitian Revolution in the first instance, 1791 to 1804, which ignites a general crisis in the entire slave system that could be resolved only with its collapse, not only in the United States, but in the Americas. With regard to U.S. apartheid, Jim Crow, we've made reference to the international pressure generated by Paul Robeson and forces on the left by taking the United States before the internet, before the international community, before the United Nations, creating a dynamic which even the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledges in its epical Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954, making specific references to the point that the United States is losing credibility and altitude because of U.S. Jim Crow. And so those particular dynamics have not disappeared or dissipated one iota. The international community is our ally. It's our ally with regard, not only with issues regard to war and peace, our subject for today, but also with regard to combating police terror and combating these other ills that are afflicting our community. So I assume our time is rapidly expiring. So I'd just like to thank you for inviting me onto this program. And I look forward to engaging with you sooner rather than later.